Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I'm joined by John Wagley, and we are talking all about the 2013 adaptation of Carrie. This is the fourth Carrie movie I have seen, and I'm hoping I won't have to watch another one for quite some time. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course, and with this being a more recent adaptation, it was interesting to see how it differed from the three previous ones I had watched. What is your relationship like with this movie? Had you seen it before?
I had not seen it before. I've seen all the other ones before, but I had not seen this one before. And I watched it the other night, and I'd never seen it. I never saw the point of it, so it never really interested me.
Yeah, I didn't even know this one existed until I went through and made the spreadsheet for this podcast, basically. I knew about the Sissy Spacek one, because that's the one most people know about. And then I was like, there's a sequel? And then there's two remakes? This is a lot. But, you know, to dive on in here, I do want to talk a little bit about the cast, especially, you know, our white family. You have Chloe Grace Moretz as Carrie, and you have Julianne Moore as Margaret White. And I think I liked the casting enough, but one thing that threw me was, you know, just looking at Chloe Grace Moretz in comparison to Sissy Spacek and just seeing the differences in how they look just as people, I was kind of like, I don't think this is working as well as they wanted, just because it's kind of hard when you have a character like Carrie and we're so used to seeing her as, you know, Sissy Spacek.
At first, I was pleasantly surprised because I thought that she looked young enough. She looks like she's
She was the proper age at the time, teenager? If I'm not mistaken.
Right. Which is great. Yeah. And then I, out of curiosity, I looked up, you know, Sissy Spacek's age, and she was like 26 when she filmed it. So I'm like, okay, well, this is a good thing. But then it just didn't seem to add a whole lot for me. And the other thing with her, I thought she was very good, but she didn't really look like an outsider to me. She looked just a little shy, maybe. But she didn't really look like someone who wouldn't fit in, I guess.
That was my thing, too. I was like, there's nothing about her that really screams outsider. It's like, okay, her clothes are a little out of date, but otherwise she just looks like another high school student.
She's an introvert. That's fine. She's not going to draw attention to herself. There are a lot of us like that. So yeah, that was a missed opportunity, I guess I should say. I think that was the problem with the script more than anything else, because I thought her performance was pretty good, all things considered.
Yeah, and then you have your other characters who I think were also cast pretty well. This felt like a very 2013 cast, especially for all of the teenagers. And, you know, Julianne Moore and Chloe Grace Moretz, Portia Doubleday as Chris Hargensen, Gabriella Wilde as Sue Snell, and you also have a couple of familiar faces in Judy Greer and Barry Shabaka Henley. I had seen in things just throughout the years. He was the principal. And yeah, I like the Judy Greer appearance too.
I thought Julianne Moore was very good.
Yeah, Julianne Moore was a standout for me, because following Piper Laurie, especially from the first movie, it's like, that's another performance that's just hard to live up to. But they made Julianne Moore look the part, because I was like, she's not that old, is she? And, you know, this was 8 years ago now. So back then, too, I was like, oh, okay, they did age her up a little and kind of made her look a little more haggard, I guess. And you're just like, okay, I see this. And some of the scenes, I think, even if this wasn't a fantastic movie, the cast did everything they could with it. And you could tell they took it very seriously and really tried to make it their own, despite knowing how iconic the De Palma movie is.
Yes, definitely. And I thought Julianne Moore did great. Like I said, it was interesting because I also watched the 1976 version recently, and where Piper Laurie is kind of going bigger and bigger, I felt like Julianne Moore was going smaller and smaller, which really made her different. And also it worked quite well.
Yeah, it was one of those things where you could tell they were like, okay, we're going to do something a little different. You know, you have her interacting with Sue's mom at the dry cleaners, and you can tell she's like tucked away in the back corner and isn't really someone who goes out and deals with people at the counter. So to have that interaction, I was like, okay, and you see like the marks on her legs, and they just feed you little pieces. And I think Julianne Moore did a very nice job with the role.
Yeah. And it really mirrored Carrie's performance as well, because you could tell where her mother was kind of an introvert, especially in that scene you just mentioned with Sue Snell's mom. You could tell that, oh, she's an introvert. She doesn't feel comfortable around people. And that's mirrored in her daughter.
It really is. And I think that's something that they do well too, because you have the fact that, like we said, Carrie doesn't really look like an outsider, just because, you know, we can probably make a safe assumption here that Chloe Grace Moretz is someone who definitely is not like an outsider by any means in her regular life. So it's not that she couldn't play the character well. I think just the way she looked, and they didn't really do quite as much to make her look the part like they did with Julianne Moore.
No. I saw this comparison elsewhere online with other reviews. It looked like she looked like the first act of a She's All That type movie, where it's like, okay, here's the plain girl, and there's going to turn her into a beautiful swan in the second and third act. I never really bought that she wasn't a popular girl at the school and didn't fit in.
Yeah, that was something that's tough, because if you don't get Carrie right from the start, it kind of colors your thoughts for the rest of the movie. Basically, you're kind of like, oh, this is kind of hard to believe, because, you know, we probably all knew girls who looked like Chloe in high school, and you're like, no, those were the popular kids.
Yeah, exactly.
But cast aside, you know, they follow the story pretty closely. They always change stuff up, but you have the whole period scene, which, you know, no matter who is in these movies, that scene is always one of the hardest things to watch, because of how formidable that is for someone who is in high school.
Right. It was definitely difficult to watch. I thought they were going to go in a different direction, since the first scene is them playing volleyball in the pool. And I thought, are they going to have anything happen in the swimming pool instead of the shower? That would have been an interesting choice. But then it reverted back to what we were expecting.
Yeah, the story is the story. You know, none of these movies are really going to change the story too much. I think the 2002 version actually changed it the most, and it made some interesting choices, but this one felt very close to the De Palma movie. You could tell they were like doing the same sort of thing. And with these scenes, it ends up being just how good is the cast? And we've already stated some of our, you know, qualms with it, but I think there was a scene at the end or towards the end where sometimes it's just the effects that make things work for you, especially certain scenes, like when Julianne Moore is in the closet and then you see her fingernails and it's just so gruesome. And then when you have Chris Hargensen going through the windshield and her head is just like stuck, I was like, okay, they got me with those two scenes.
That was interesting. Those are the two that stuck out for me as well. I after that, though, when she levitated the car and made it fly into the gas station, it lost me a little bit. But seeing Chris trapped in the windshield with the beautiful spider web of splinters around her face really, really was effective.
Yeah, there were just certain shots where I was like, okay, they got that part right. That's where a lot of the budget went, you know. And one of the other things that I found interesting about this was the amount of self-harm they show with Margaret. They leaned into that a lot more, because in the book, you always get this picture of Margaret, and then after you see the De Palma movie, Piper Laurie is just stuck in your head because of her fantastic performance. But they took this and they really ran with Margaret's character more than I expected them to. And some of those scenes were just tough to watch and just gross and gruesome.
I agree. They were very effective. As far as running with Margaret, though, I really wish they would have done more. The very first scene was her giving birth to Carrie, and I thought, oh, this will be interesting because maybe it'll be from Margaret's point of view, and we'll get more of that story. And then it kind of reverted back to the Carrie story we already know. So that was a little bit disappointing for me, and that they didn't really expand with Margaret. I did think that they added some very nice scenes between Margaret and Carrie, where, unlike in the other adaptations, I really did get the sense that Margaret loved Carrie. For instance, when Margaret picks up Carrie after the incident in the shower, she picks her up, they get in the car, and you're not sure how it's going to go, but then Margaret reaches over and takes Carrie's hand, which I thought was a really nice touch and really showed that Margaret does love her daughter. But they're both just fractured people, I guess.
What I find really interesting about this adaptation too, is that they did bring back Lawrence D. Cohen for the screenplay. And it's kind of interesting to see that he worked on the 76 one and this one. And then you also have Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, but I love his work. He's done a lot of stuff in the Archie world and he does great horror stuff. So to have those two people behind the story, I think that's why they kept it a little closer to De Palma's version and the book.
I think from what I did a little research into that because I was really fascinated by it because I noticed that as well. I believe, and I'm going to probably massacre his name too, but I believe that they hired Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa to write a screenplay, and I'm going to put my own little slant on this because I've seen this happen in the theater world, and they said, we want you to do something new. We don't want it to resemble the De Palma film. We want something new. And he turned in a screenplay, and it seems like the producers then said, what did you do? You did something new. Bring in Lawrence Cohen so he can make it more like the original.
So they did some reshoots.
There was,
I think,
an element. Yeah, they did. It was the same thing with the director. They were told her, you know, we want your vision. We want this, we want that. And then she turned in the film and they said, oh, no, we need to do reshoots and make it more of a remake than a new interpretation, which I don't understand at all, but I'm not in Hollywood. So
obviously, with a lot of the elements being the same, there's probably not a ton to talk about story-wise. We've touched on, you know, Margaret in them taking her in a little bit of a different direction with all of the self-harm and everything. But for the most part, the high school scenes were exactly what I expected. You know, a lot of them did mirror what we already knew. You have Sue convincing Tommy to take Carrie to the prom. And Tommy genuinely seems like a nice guy, which, you know, I will note that I've seen things in the news about Ansel Elgort and his allegations against him and all of these sorts of things. So watching him be as charming as he was in the movie, I was like, oh, but I know what you've done now, or, you know, what he allegedly done now. So it kind of, it's one of those things where, like, when I watched Apt Pupil or something, knowing Bryan Singer was involved, I was like, okay, I have to think about this in the time when it was made. And obviously, things that have come out since are still important to mention, which is why I try to always mention them here. But Tommy is a character who is written to be genuinely kind to Carrie, and I think that came across well here too.
Definitely. He fit the part. I didn't look. I remembered that there were allegations against him, but I didn't look them up because I didn't want it to color my viewing of his performance. But he seemed like the wonderful athletic high school guy that Tommy Ross is supposed to be. So I just left it that. I don't know if I enjoyed him as much as other people that have been in the role, but he didn't do anything to bother my opinion too much in the movie, I'll say.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to not compare this to the original movie because of how similar it is because of Lawrence D. Cohen's reshoots and things like that, his rewriting of the script. And, you know, Chris and Billy were what I expected to. I mean, Billy in this movie is no John Travolta, but, you know, he plays the role well enough. Alex Russell, who has been in a few things that I've seen now, but really, I think the high school kids, most of them, they were fine. You know, it wasn't groundbreaking performances from anyone. It's like they got their parts. They knew what they had to do because how could you not probably with a movie like this? And then they did what they could with it, you know?
I felt like all of the high school kids, for the most part, were generic, except, you know, Sue stands out a little bit. Chris and Billy and Tommy all stand a little bit because they're bigger roles, but I wouldn't have been able to tell you anything about any of the other ones. And I felt even they were just a little bit of a high school mean girl, high school nice girl, high school athlete, high school troublemaker, and not a whole lot beyond that. And maybe that's because of my perception, because I'm familiar with the characters. And they didn't do anything new, so maybe I shouldn't be criticizing them for just sticking to what they were supposed to do, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with the script, not necessarily who was cast in those roles. It's like, you can only do so much with what you're given, and because they weren't really given anything new, I think that's why Julianne Moore got to shine a little more in this, because they did do something slightly new with the character, and I did like that, but, you know, otherwise, it's kind of the same thing and just not as good. It's not terrible, but it's just, it's fine.
It's not bad. I want to pause for 1 second and say that I am always open-minded to new adaptations. I'm not one of those people that automatically doesn't like remakes or new adaptations. But this one falls into that category of why people don't like remakes. There was no reason for it. You know, Julianne Moore got to play a good role. Good for her. It didn't justify its existence for me, especially when the original is so iconic.
Yeah, it was kind of like when I watched Mick Garris's version of The Shining, which is obviously much more faithful to the novel than Kubrick's. But it's like, Kubrick's is such a good horror movie that watching then a TV miniseries on The Shining just doesn't feel as big, you know?
Exactly. The TV version of The Shining, I'm not nuts about. I understand why they made it, and I'm glad Stephen King got to make it. He got to write the screenplay and get it the way he wanted and try to fix some of those problems, but it just didn't work as well as the Kubrick version. It just wasn't as scary or as interesting.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there is one more scene that I want to specifically mention because it stood out to me. And that's at the end where you have Carrie and Sue together. And Carrie knows that Sue is pregnant and that it's a girl. And you have this moment where Sue's kind of like, what are you talking about? But because we saw her like run into the bathroom earlier, you know, we can piece it together. And I just kind of felt like, given everything we knew about Carrie, that seemed a little misplaced.
Yeah, there were all sorts of weird things with Carrie's powers. We know she's got telekinesis, but in this film, she's also got pyrokinesis. She can start fires when she melted the lock on the closet. She can fly. She was flying across the room in the prom scene. She can control the wind. She can stomp the street like the Incredible Hulk and send a crack all the way up to Chris and Billy's car. So when she said, oh, it's a girl, I was like, is this some other weird kind of superpower that we don't know about? If it would have been in the book, it would have made sense, because in the book, there's all this stuff with people just knowing things while all this stuff is going on. At one point, Sue goes to the roadhouse and she says, I don't know why I knew Carrie was there. I just knew. So in the book, it would have made sense. But in this, it was just one more thing where it's like, what exactly are her powers?
Yeah, the whole flying thing, I was willing to let that slide. I was like, okay, well, if Carrie can move other objects, maybe she can move herself in the same kind of way.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, that one gets a pass. But then some of the other stuff, like you mentioned, stomping like the Incredible Hulk and, you know, cracking the street, you're just like, is this also supposed to be a superhero movie? Because that's definitely not what the book is.
Right. I also with the prom scene and her flying, that once the first half of the movie, I was okay with the CGI. And then once we got to the pig's blood scene, I was like, okay, I can't buy the CGI anymore.
Yeah, they really had a lot going on.
A lot. And, you know, the pig's blood. And then she creates like a tsunami that wipes everybody in the gym away. And I was like, what is this? It's always fascinating to me how a movie almost 50 years ago now, 1976, the effects look better than cutting edge 2013. It's something that I keep coming back to whenever I watch stuff.
I think it really helps that a lot of the older movies relied more on practical effects and sort of editing styles to cover some things up, because you have certain choices made with De Palma's version that kind of either cut quickly or, you know, when they do like the split screen thing, and this, you're kind of like, they're just going to use CGI and it's not going to hold up as well. And usually this is something I notice more with like early 2000s movies. Like if you watch the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, the swinging through New York City doesn't look quite as good, which they didn't use it a ton. They didn't rely on that a lot for those movies, but you can tell that like early 2000s, I was like, ooh, a lot of the CGI stuff isn't going to hold up. So the fact that it didn't hold up from 2013, I was like, oh, they must not have had a big budget for this, really.
And then the problem is, and we've already talked about this scene a couple times, but the scene with Chris in the windshield, which was CGI, when you see a scene that does work, it makes all the scenes that don't work look even worse.
Yeah, and I feel like that might have been maybe a mix of like CGI and practical, which may be why it worked a little better. And, you know, stuff like Julianne Moore's fingernails, obviously they didn't really do that to her fingernails, but that looked good. And I will note that this budget was $30 million, which that's a smaller budget for, you know, a big box office movie. And it made about $85 million. So it did at least have some success. But the way I phrased it in my Letterboxd review was, this was watchable, but 100% unnecessary.
That's the perfect way to put it. I would agree with that. And I would also add that it's watchable, but I don't think it's rewatchable.
Correct. Yeah. This is not one I will be rewatching. I think, you know, to just talk about these Carrie movies as a whole, we've talked about how the first one is iconic. The sequel, I was kind of like, this is weird, but okay. You know, at least they tried something new. The 2002 one, because it was a TV movie, I was like, this isn't a story that can be a TV movie, really. And I mean, Angela Bettis does what she can with it. And then this one, I was like, who asked for this?
I agree 100%. The Angela Bettis one, I didn't mind it near as much as I minded this one, because I like her so much. And also since they did different things. And then the end of that one is so crazy, where Carrie and Sue go to Florida to fight crime or something. That kind of made it worth it for me.
Yeah, I was like, oh, well, you know, at least they tried something different. And you have like the police interviews to kind of break up the original kind of story that we're used to seeing. I really feel like this one was just one of those things where I was like, I'm obviously going to watch it for the podcast, but I probably won't find myself reaching to watch this one again.
No, but kudos to the cast for doing a good job, and Julianne Moore. And as we said, you mentioned Judy Greer, who I wanted to say I also enjoyed quite a bit of this. So.
She was just a fun appearance. She didn't really have like a ton to do. She was kind of just coming to Carrie's defense the whole time, which that's what the character is, you know, from the book too. So I thought that was fine. But overall, you know, again, it was fine. Do you have any other thoughts? I know we've kind of kept things brief here, but, you know, for me, this is the fourth rodeo here. So
right. We've kind of covered everything that I felt about it. you know, that they set out to make one movie, and then the creative people were told by the producers to just remake the old one. I would have loved to have seen what their vision would have been like, but
same,
we just won't get to.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate because especially knowing the work that Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa has done in like the Archie comics and with Riverdale and Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, I would have loved to see something along those lines because those are both high school age settings. So I think that's kind of where he excels. And I would have loved to see what that version would have been like if they could have done something a little darker with it, because despite how dark the Carrie story is, this version feels like fairly light in not only tone, but kind of like in the look and feel of the movie as well. A lot of it happens during the day, and I'm like, I kind of want a grittier version of Carrie almost.
Yeah, agreed. I was excited, maybe not excited, it's not the right word, but when I saw his name as a screenwriter, it did pique my interest, knowing that that's where he excels in his writing. I didn't look this up, but I know there is an episode of Riverdale where they do Carrie the musical, and I'm wondering if he actually wrote that episode as well.
I've watched all of the episodes of that show, and I can't recall if he did that one, but when I saw they were doing that, because like musicals aren't entirely my thing, so I was like, okay, this will be interesting, but anytime any show does something that's related to Stephen King, I'm just like, I'm in, you know, I'm in for the ride.
I watched that episode just so I could hear the song, because I've never seen it or heard any of the original cast recording or anything, but that was fun.
Yeah, those are some of the odds and ends that I haven't sought out for this podcast, because I know there's like a Misery play with Bruce Willis or something like that. And you have the Carrie musical, and you have a few other things here and there. I think there's some audio dramas for The Mist and maybe one or two other things. Yeah. But, you know, those are things where I'm like, okay, you know, maybe that's content down the line, because I really wanted to focus a lot more on obviously the books, but the movies and TV adaptations, because those are the things people are going to be most familiar with.
Yeah.
Whether they realize some of these stories are Stephen King or not. Like, I've had people be like, oh, The Green Mile's a Stephen King thing? That seems odd or something like that. So, you know, 4 Carrie movies down, I have done it.
Now we'll watch the 5th one in 2038. Or something, who knows?
Oh, no. But last thing before we go here, I like doing some ratings. I gave this a 2.5 out of 5. It was very middle of the road.
I gave it a 2 out of 5. If I would have not minded ever watching it again, maybe I would have gone to 2.5. But for me, it was 2 out of 5, because there just was more that didn't work that did.
I was like, you know what? I watched it. It's done. Not going to go back to it anytime soon, if at all.
Yeah, agreed.
But John, is there anything you want to plug before we go to?
No, not upcoming. I have a collection of short stories coming out in 2022, but nothing in the near future. I'm a short story and writer and playwright, so I have stuff come and go. But right now, the big thing is not until 2022.
Well, I look forward to that. I'll link to your Twitter in the show notes so people can check out your stuff there. And thank you so much for coming on to talk about the 2013 Carrie.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.